Accession number 17129, Reel 1.
This is a recording of an interview with Wing Commander Roland Beaumont, recorded by Rodney Giesler in Pentridge, Dorset, on the 7th of November 1996 for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive.
Wing Commander Beaumont, can I pick up your story from the end of the war onwards? You were unfortunate enough to be taken prisoner just towards the end of the war. And when did you actually get released and come back to Britain?
Well, we didn't get back until about 4 weeks after the end of hostilities, because our camp, which was Stalag 3A at Luckenwalde near Potsdam, was overrun by the Russians, and the Russians didn't think it necessary or convenient, shall we say, to release the British and American prisoners of war, and we were held, many of us felt, as hostages for rather a long time. Eventually, a large column of American vehicles with their white stars on it turned up at the side of our camp early one morning, headed up by a young American captain who said he was coming to take the boys home. And the Russians said, the hell you are, go back from whence you came. And there was a long and very loud discussion between the Americans and the Russians, with our people looking on rather hopefully, which was eventually decided later that day by the Russians saying, if you don't take your vehicles away from here within 5 minutes, we open fire. And they brought up some armoured vehicles, pointed their guns at the Americans, and sure enough, that when the 5 minutes was up, there was a burst of machine gun fire into the air, of course, and the Americans decided that was it and they had to go. And so we were left wondering what the future was going to be. About 2 weeks after that, we were turfed out at dawn, and there was a line of Russian trucks with Russian red stars on the side, and we were piled on these trucks and taken down to the Elbe and handed over at a bridge over the Elbe near Kassel, handed over to Americans, who took us over from then. So we got back home. I can't remember the exact date. I think it was probably somewhere around about June the 2nd or June the 4th, to find that this country had sort of forgotten there was a war and was busily involved in electioneering for the coming general election.
Now, you stayed in the Royal Air Force for a little while on, did you? I mean, what did you have plans when you got released? Did you think what you were going to do in Civvy Street in post-war life?
Yes and no. I had a slightly confused situation. This goes back actually to when I became a prisoner of war. In October 1944, when I was wing leader at Volkel with the Tempest Wing, I had five squadrons of Tempests, and we were in a very good position. We were the most further advanced fighter station in Second Taff. We were actually within shelling distance of the nearest German positions, and we were having a very busy war. And one evening, my old friend and chief from the Hawker Company, Philip Lucas, flew out to see us, have a visit to these Tempests. And over dinner that evening, he said, well, I've been talking to P-Staff, that's RAF postings. He said, your tour of operations, I was on my third tour at the time, is just about to expire, and I gather that if you want to, you can come back on attachment to Hawkers for the experimental flying post until the war ends, and then if you want to, it's, we would like to have you come on our permanent staff. And so in the course of a half hour's conversation, I seem to be being offered a permanent position in a very, very interesting job indeed for after the war, at a time when everybody else was wondering what the hell was going to happen to them. So this was a unique situation. I also thought that I would like to stay in the Air Force. 2 days after that, I got myself shot down on the wrong side of the Rhine, so that changed the priorities. When I came home, I got on to Philip Lucas at Hawkers and said, well, we had this interesting conversation 6 months ago. And he said, well, we couldn't keep the job open, B. Obviously, it's been filled. We're very sorry about that. And he gave me a bottle of gin and wished me well. By that time, I had made my application for a permanent commission, because I was serving on the active reserve at the time. And we were all of us who were in this situation were told that it would take some time for the post-war organisation to settle itself down, and that the applicants for permanent commissions would all receive attention in due course, but it would be some months. In the meantime, I'd been notified that my Class A reserve release was due on the 1st of January the following year, 1st of January 1946. In the meantime, I had been posted to an organisation called the Tactics Branch at Central Fighter Establishment at Tangmere, with a lot of my old friends, sort of time-expired wing leaders. It was great fun. Douglas Bardow was commanding it, and there were people like Bob Stamford Tuck and Dennis David and Pete Brothers, all the old wing leaders. And we had a very good summer. One of the interesting things we did was to interrogate the German prisoners, Adolf Galland and Heinz Rudel, both of whom have been injured in the last few weeks of the war. And then my posting came up to command, foreman command, a new wing of Hawker Tempest 2s at Chilbolton. Tempest 2 was the development of the Tempest that I had operated on with the Centaurus engine. It was an improved Tempest. So I went to Chilbolton and began to work that wing up, led them in the first victory fly past over London on the 15th of September that year, which was a shambles. Awful weather, terrible weather. From there, I was told that my task would be to lead the new Tempest wing out to Tiger Force and to continue the war against the Japs. I don't know when any of us were terribly enthusiastic about starting another war at that time, after we just finished one in Europe, but obviously that's what we were going to do. But then the Japanese war ended with the atom bomb, and my next posting was back to the Central Fighter Establishment, where I was given command of an outfit called the Air Fighting Development Squadron, which was just that. It was the unit which assessed new aeroplanes in their respective qualities for the operations they were designed to do. That was an interesting task, suited me very well. And then on January the...
What base was that at?
At West Raynham.
West Raynham.
Then on January the 1st, or thereabouts, I was released from the Air Force, and no sign of a permanent commission coming through. And I had a wife and some children to start thinking about. And so I had put out a few feelers. Just before all this happened, the Air Force gave me a dining out together with Wimpy Wade, who became the chief test pilot of Hawkers about the same time as I joined English Electric. And we had quite a party, which I can remember very little detail. And then I found myself out of the Air Force after 7 years, and I really enjoyed my time in the world's best, world's finest Air Force. It was a wonderful experience. I didn't want to leave them, but I had no choice. I was released on the reserve. and I had to find occupation. With having had contacts with the aircraft industry through Hawkers, I found that there was a job available at Gloucester's as an experimental test pilot on the then new Mark IV development of the Meteor. And I went down, and I went to see the chief test pilot, Eric Greenwood, and he outlined the future. He said that he was about to retire from the post, and that if I came in to join them, then it would be as a prospective next chief test pilot. So I thought, well, that sounds all right. Beginning of the jet era, it was quite interesting. It gave...
Have you flown a jet at this time?
Oh, I had, yes. Yes, I flew one of the first ones at Manston in 44, the year before. I wasn't terribly impressed with it, but that's not really the subject for this particular conversation. So I went to Gloucester's and established my wife and our, one of our two children in a hiring at North Leech in the Cotswolds, where the other one was with grandparents. And this was all a very fluid period just after the war. It was taking a bit of time to settle down. And after I'd been at Gloucester's for about 3 months, I found myself right into the development of this Meteor 4, which was an interesting job. It was the Meteor was the first British operational jet fighter, and the 4 was a very much uprated version of it with engines that gave about twice the power of the original engines.
That's the one you flew at Manston.
That's right. Yeah. And this thing was capable of somewhere of the order of 600 miles an hour or a little bit more, which was very fast in those days. And I soon found myself doing compressibility dives. That was diving the aeroplane to its limits in relation to the speed of sound. It was not capable of penetrating the speed of sound, because it wasn't the right shape. But we had to establish just how far you could get towards the speed of sound, and around about 79 or 80% of the speed of sound, the Meteor used to get into very heavy compressibility buffeting. It had a powerful nose-down trim change. It used to roll very violently, and it got to a point where the pilot could scarcely control it. Well, these limits had to be established so that the Air Force could be clearly briefed on it, and that was my task to do that work.
The Mark IV presumably was coming off the production lines.
It was in experimental at when I joined. There were only two or three experimental aeroplanes, but it was beginning to come down the production line. Now, in the course of all this, it was apparent that one of these experimental Mark IVs had the previous year, 6 months previously, established a new world speed record in the hands of Willie Wilson and Eric Greenwood. And the Air Force announced that they wanted to uprate the speed of the aeroplane by putting slightly more powerful engines in, and that they wanted to attack the record again, to put it further out of the reach of the Americans. This meant that two specially prepared Meteors had to be proved to a safe margin above the highest speed that the Air Force were going to operate. And that became my task. And that was interesting flying. We used to fly down the Severn Estuary past Avonmouth, right on the deck, I mean 50 feet or so, getting it as fast as it could possibly go. And I did, I suppose, about six or seven of these flights. And then on the final occasion, when we thought we knew all about it, we were going to go for broke and really get it to the absolute limit. And we had to wait for a warm day for this. And the day arrived, and I took this aeroplane to the beginning of the Severn Estuary, just near Moreton Valence Airfield. And worked it up to its high speed in a shallow dive. West-southwest was down the Severn Estuary. When I got it to just about the maximum speed that we'd seen before in previous tests, about 608 miles an hour or something like that, I'd still got about 300 feet in hand, and I pushed the nose down a bit more just to get the last ounce of speed, and all of a sudden the aeroplane started to buck and make very loud roaring noises. The nose went down, and an instinctive two-handed pull on the stick didn't seem to be raising the nose, and we were then in crisis corner. The aeroplane was tearing along, getting faster and faster, aiming at the water, which was just a blur, and I thought within seconds we're hitting the water and there's nothing I can do about it. Luckily, it did actually respond. I suppose I must have pulled a very heavy force on the stick, and it did gradually respond. How much it cleared the water by, I don't know, but it was very, very close. And when we got back off this and we reviewed it, and the flight test engineers reduced the speed that I thought I'd seen, with instrument error, temperature of the day and all the rest of it, they said, well, blimey, that's a true speed of 632 miles an hour. And I said, well, that's fine, but what we shall have to do, the last speed I saw on the ASI was somewhere around about 615. We shall have to issue these aeroplanes to the Air Force with a never-exceed speed of about 610. And they did their calculations. They said, yes, well, this should, if they can repeat that, this should give them a true speed down the measured run of 616 miles per hour, which will be enough.
But on the actual speed of the officially timed record, you had to fly straight and level. You couldn't do
that's
any,
right.
Any
that's right.
Crafty dives.
That's right.
Anything,
but there still had to be a decent margin. Mm. We couldn't have them, for whatever reason, getting anywhere near this out of control condition. Mm. So I then delivered this aeroplane to Tangmere and the spare, Teddy Donaldson and Neville Duke, and who was the other chap? I can't remember.
Willie Wilson again.
No, it was the Canadian who went to Ross.
Bill Waterton,
that's right. Yes. They were the flight there. And they set about doing the world speed record, and they achieved 660 miles per hour, level flight, both ways, and it was a very great success. But the embarrassment for me, and for all of us at Gloucester's, was that a totally over-enthusiastic PR man in the Gloucester department heard this discussion between the engineers on the day of this flight of 632 miles an hour. And the following day, the Daily Express had British jet exceeds world speed record. Wing Commander Beaumont reaches 632 miles an hour. And this, of course, before the Air Force has had a chance. And no way were they ever going to do that. Because mine was a dive, as you say, and theirs was level. And this was a great embarrassment. In the meantime, while all this was going on, a buff envelope arrived one morning with the Air Ministry seal on the back, inviting me to attend at Ad Astral House for induction for my permanent commission on the following Monday. By that time, Pat and I had been established as civilians for a couple of months, and you know, there seemed to be a career opening up ahead of us, and so we had to decide what to do. I was very, very in two minds. I mean, I loved the Air Force. I didn't really think my chances of a civilian career in the Air Force might have been as good as they had during wartime, because it was a different scene. Nevertheless, a lot of my contemporaries stayed in and became air marshals and so on. I was quite attracted to the idea of staying out in the industry at the beginning of the jet era. It was all starting. It was going to be very exciting. I mean, we could already see that there were going to be swept wings coming, and the chances of getting near to or even penetrating the so-called sound barrier were looming up. And I thought, I'm in at the right place. If I stay in now, I'm going to get some very interesting flying. But was it fair to the family and all that? And we discussed the comparisons of living as members of a civil industry in an industrial park.
What were you being paid at Gloucester's at the time? What was your salary? Can you tell me roughly?
It was about the same as an Air Force wing commander, which I suppose would have been about $1,000 a year. Mm. Something like that. 950, that sort of order.
Well, that's more than it sounds like now in those days, presumably. Mm. I mean, one could live reasonably well on it?
Or? Oh, yes. I mean, you know, you weren't living a life of luxury. You had to count the pennies, but you could live satisfactorily, you know. You could afford to run a very second-hand car. And if I went into... if I'd stayed with Gloucesters, I had the prospect of becoming a chief test pilot with a tremendous target of possibly being paid $1,500 a year. if I went back into the Air Force, I would go down one rank, because I was an acting wing commander. I'd go back down to squadron leader and take my chances from there on.
Who were the people at Gloucester at the time? I mean, was Greenwood still there?
Eric Greenwood was chief test pilot. Philip Stanbury was notionally the deputy, but he was sick. He was off ill. And George Carter, who was the chief designer, wanted Philip Stanbury to come back and become chief test pilot. Philip Stanbury didn't think he was going to make it. In fact, he never did. This is where my change occurred. I went to see Eric Greenwood and I said, look, I've been here for a few months. I've got this problem of going back into the Air Force coming up. Can you promise me that I will get chief test pilot? He said, no, I can't do that. George Carter wants Philip Stanbury. So I said, well, that's not how I understood it when I joined. And Eric said... No, that's the situation that's occurred now. However, if you hang on a bit, it will all simmer down, and eventually I've no doubt that you'll get chief test pilot. And Pat and I discussed this, and we decided that it wasn't as cast iron as it sounded. And I then went up to see the CNC of Fighter Command, Sir James Robb, and asked for his advice on coming back in for permanent commission. And he was a bit stuffy about that, and he said, well, what's the problem? I said, well, I've been offered a permanent commission. He said, well, take it. So I explained that I was 25 and I thought I'd got a fair amount of flying ahead of me, and I was a bit worried about coming back into the Air Force to see what the prospects would be. And he said, Beaumont, tell me, how long have you been in flying posts in the Air Force? So I said, 7 years. And he said, sir. And he said, well, in a balanced career, you can expect 7 years on the ground. I said, that's what I was afraid of, sir, and we went out and became civilians.
Of course, you mentioned just now that there were, you know, the sweat wings and things were coming along, and even as a schoolboy, I can remember the excitement of going to Farnborough just after the war.
Yes.
The numbers of prototypes that were there, and the new exciting shapes.
Extraordinary, wasn't it? Yes, yes.
And then, of course, I suppose you were getting, in the industry, all the input from the German design,
yep,
team, the paperclip operation.
Right, that's right.
That was being fed into the design departments.
Yeah.
And, yep, of course, again, it was a huge sort of quantum leap in flying as well.
We had our experts. Well, we haven't come to that yet, no. but I after leaving Gloucesters, I went to English Electric.
You approached them, or did they approach
you? No, I approached them. Mm. Because I knew... a chap called Sammons, who's the managing director of Napier's for my collection with the Hawker Tempests, and he was on the board of English Electric. And I got in touch with him and I said, I understand that English Electric are developing the B-345, which I knew was a potential jet bomber with Avon axial flow engines. It sounded to me like a very, very exciting project. And I said, I just wondered whether the English Electric have got a test pilot. And he wrote back and he said, I think they probably haven't, wait one. And then I got invited rather quickly to go up and see Teddy Patter. And that clinched the deal and he took me on.
Had you made your American trip when you flew the F-86 by this time?
No, no, that was one of the first things Teddy did.
Yeah.
He was developing the Canberra, which was going to be my task. I was going to be open up Wharton's flight testing, which was a derelict American base. Wharton's flight test centre for English Electric was my job to develop it. And we started our test flying there with a Meteor for further research into transonic flight, with myself in charge of the operation, Bill Eaves as a flight shed foreman and one works policeman, and nobody else. Bill Eaves used to drive the tractor to pull the aeroplane out. And he then used, once I got the engine started, he'd climb into his car, rush off down the runway with an Aldis light and give me reds and greens as he was air traffic. That's right.
It's an extraordinary thing. When the Canberra was first announced and revealed to the public, I'd never heard of English Electric as an aviation
company. Had anybody, no.
Now, how did that come about? I mean, because Petter was originally at Westlands.
Well, I'll tell you exactly how that came about. In the Great Nuffield Expansion Scheme, pre-war, English Electric, who were identified as a successful locomotive engineering manufacturing organisation in Preston, were invited to consider whether they would take on subcontract work to build aircraft for the expansion after the Munich crisis. George Nelson, Sir George, Lord Nelson, as he eventually became, decided that this was the thing that they could take on. They had built aeroplanes in the 1920s, but there's a long background history there. They built nothing since the 1920s in the aircraft field. But George Nelson went into cooperation with the government on a subcontract with Handy Page to build Hamden bombers, twin-engine bombers. They built these rather well, rather quickly, and discharged that contract very well. And as a result of that, the war by then, of course, had started. Handy Page were then commanded by the government to subcontract a substantial portion of the new Halifax four-engine bomber contract to English Electric. I can't remember how many they built, but they built many hundreds of four-engine bombers at Samlesbury and built them to a very high standard. By that time, in, I suppose, round about the end of 44, beginning of 45, when the war was obviously about to end, and we had a government in those days that seemed to look ahead a lot more than it does these days, shall we say. They were already talking about the two things: the great rundown in manufacturing capacity that was going to happen after the war. Factories were going to have to close, there'd be mass redundancies. But in parallel to all this was the complication of the fact that the new jet era was going to dramatically change aviation. We were going to increase performance by 50% or even more, in one last vast step, by building aeroplanes that could accommodate gas turbine power. And we, if we were going to stay in the aviation world, we were going to have to compete with America and with any other emergent countries. Germany was out of the race at that time. France would come back in. America was the obvious world leader. And the British government said, right, we're going to be in this. And they started to consider in 45 contracting with de Havilland's for their experimental development, which became the Vampire, for Droster's with the Meteor, which was already in production, to develop it into higher powered forms. And then there came the question of jet bombers. There had to be a strategic jet bomber, which would have to have four engines and have blind bombing capability. The British government thought that was probably too big a step in one, and rather they would contract for two alternative four-engine jet bombers. They were, as a first stage, have a more simple twin-engine jet bomber, which would have the functions of replacing the Mosquito light bomber, and have the ability to take on some of the heavy bomber roles as well, because of its capacity to carry considerable weights long distances. English Electric were contracted by the government with the development of the twin-engine bomber, the B-345, a 1945 specification.
Was that specification put out to any other companies?
I don't know about that. I haven't any recollection of that one at all. That's an interesting question. You'd have to ask the Ministry of Defence Archives about that, I think. Put it this way, I joined English Electric as their chief test pilot specifically for the B-345 program, what, 3 years before it flew, no, 2 years before its first flight. In that 2 years, I never heard any mention of other contenders which we might have beaten for the contract. If there had been contenders, I'm sure there would have been talk about it. But anyway...
Was Teddy Petter brought to English Electric
specifically to do that?
Yes, right.
The government said, right, English Electric are going to build this aeroplane. They haven't got a design team, and how they put it about, I don't know. But they employed Teddy Petter specifically to form a design team at Preston to build the B-345. At that stage, I went up to see Teddy Petter. He wanted a pilot to take on this job, and I was selected for it. Rather interesting little sidelight to that. You never know who your friends are in this life. When I heard that this job was on, I went to see Teddy Petter. He said, well, your records and credentials appear to be appropriate. Nevertheless, I shall want a referee. You see, I remember him using that term. So I said, oh, yes, right. He said, well, if you let me know who... you would like to provide a reference for your experience, we will proceed from there. So I thought, well, so who better than Sir Roderick Hill? You probably remember that name. Sir Roderick Hill had been an RAE test pilot in World War One. He was technically very much involved with the development side of aviation. By World War II, he became Commander-in-Chief of...
Roger.